This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Well, first off, a shout out. He's back. Jason Graham back in the booth. Good to have you back, buddy.
The master at the controls.
Absolutely. The controller of the show. He's here.
I mean, he even makes us look good.
And
that's unbelievable.
And this other voice you're hearing is that of Chuck Coughlin, also familiar to our listeners.
Good to be here, Mr. Mike.
Well, we knew this was coming. We had to do it at some point. The Democrats are running a cast of thousands, and I thought what we might do is run through them and discuss. I've arranged what I think. I think you probably agree with in general, though maybe a little bit of difference around the margins. I got three tiers of candidates, and then a whole bunch of nutty, and then a couple of honorable mentions, and a couple of other things.
But yeah,
three tiers, maybe with what I would consider the viable. And I invite you to comment.
Sure.
My tier one, Biden and Bernie. The interesting thing here is I think they're the leading two candidates. Between them, over 150 years old, all white men, despite the fact that that is not the direction the Democratic Party is going. The top two most prominent Democratic candidates are the oldest, whitest guys around.
Yeah, it's an evolutionary cycle we're going through here because, you know, we just got through a primary out here in Arizona that was the extinction of the white male Democrat in the Democratic primary.
And
cycle.
Throughout the country.
Oh, yeah.
The Democrats who were pickups in Congress.
Yes.
Were mostly women and a whole lot of minorities.
Yes. I mean, that's what we saw. And we've continued to see, you know, we had some elections out here in that period of time. And what I'm seeing is, at least in Arizona, is a continued rise in Democratic participation and a fairly flat, you know, like I think most pollsters would cause enthusiasm gap between Republicans and Democrats, where Democrats are enthused and they're turning out in higher numbers than they historically have. We saw that in this record midterm election.
We saw it in midterm. You think it persists?
Well, it persisted right in the mayoral race the other day.
Yeah.
We saw 41-42% Democratic turnout in Phoenix, where it was only about a 38% Republican turnout. So it's happening, and it's continuing to happen.
And that was in a race that was nonpartisan. It was between two Democrats, though one of them, Danny Valenzuela, by the end of the race, I think a lot of people were confused about whether or not he was a Republican.
Well, and there's some dynamics there going on about, so how do we message? I mean, how do the Democrats message to that base? And like you said, you got Biden and Bernie.
You agree they're the top two. And then a gap before everybody
else.
Well,
not a big gap. I don't think a big gap, but you do see it in the poll. But you see, I'd put Kamala Harris in the second tier group, maybe with – I'd sort of got her above everybody else. I got her as the leading progressive in my book.
That was
now.
The one I was wondering about, and it may be the only place where we disagree a little bit, because my second tier is Warren and O'Rourke.
Yeah, I'm just down on what distinguishes Beto lost to Cruz in Texas. I mean, it's a. You know, it's a nice little narrative, but totally progressive, way out there. We saw them lose all the progressive candidates that got into the general, then lost. I mean, the Democratic pickups on statewide elections.
Let's be fair about what the landscape.
Texas is a little different. Right?
What's the Republican lean in Texas? About 15%.
It is.
So, in other words, he beat the spread by 13 points or something.
But I just don't.
Elizabeth Warren, by the way, was under the spread by about 12 points.
Yeah. So I don't put either of them because they both have struggled out of the gate here. Whereas Kamala Harris, the U.S. Senator from California, former Attorney General in California, has shown consistent progress. I mean, you've seen her number continue to grow. Mm-hmm. She has African American female, so she's able to just innately narrate to that more progressive part of the base, but her biography doesn't suggest she's that she's really there. Right.
Former prosecutor,
right.
Which causes her a little bit of a dissonance with the left, but
right.
maybe makes her more appealing
but
to the right.
But she's shown progress and momentum. You've seen growth in her number since mm-hmm. she, you know, in terms of favorability, name ID, you know, 538 has her growing. The 538 has her growing in popularity and name ID across the board. So I think it's really back to the older two white gentlemen that, well, one is definitely in the race. We're waiting. I think
Biden is here.
Biden. Well, we think that. But mm-hmm. the timing of that's going to be important. He had the firefighters convention this week in D.C. He spoke to the convention this week in D.C.
I watched a lot of that speech, yep. and he did everything but announce.
Yeah, right. And it's teeing up. I think what they're probably waiting for is for the Mueller report to drop. Because I think that's going to dominate the discussion, and I think we're going to see that in the next week or two. I suspect that once that happens, that's going to cloud the field substantially. The Democrats are going to, you know, the progressive part of the Democratic Party is just going to launch on that, and there will be an opportunity once the snow globe begins to settle a little bit, that for him to begin to narrate a new campaign.
Of course, Biden more than any other candidate can wait as long as he wants.
I think so. But the timing of that's important.
Mm-hmm.
And then the challenge for a Biden, in my view, is how do you, as you pointed out earlier, white, male, you know, old.
45 years of history on which one can do opposition research. We're
yep.
going to hear about Anita Hill.
Oh yeah,
the Democratic left is going to dredge
yeah.
that one up,
yeah.
even though half the electorate wasn't born when that happened.
So you're right. You're going to have all that stuff, and so Joe and Biden's campaign, it'll be really interesting to see how they narrate that story, and do they begin to define? I would think if they're going to go, that they've thought through hopefully how to narrate the difference. Economically, between Joe's not a part of the socialist wing of the Democratic Party. Let's put that out there right now. And so I would really like to see what he's going to say about capitalism and democracy and the fact that the 250 years that we've tied those two things together in human history, we've seen more human progress and human freedom. In the 250 years we've put those together than in all of human history combined. And if they're undergirded with, in Joe's world, a Judeo-Christian, mm-hmm. Jesuit-Christian value system that has a preferential treatment for the poor.
Best answer yet, by the way, that I've heard on the question of are you a capitalist? Elizabeth Warren. Her answer, yes.
Yeah.
We have to – but. Then
yeah,
there's a but.
Right.
But we have to regulate capitalism
yes.
or else it butchers people.
Yeah, because we know that free markets left to their own devices will do what capitalists do, and that would benefit themselves.
Her credentials about regulation are so good that she could give the unabashed yes. Some other people would have trouble
right.
giving that same answer.
But
for her, it was a fabulous
answer.
Well,
she's got a deep intellectual base in that thinking.
We'll talk about her up top when we return in the think tank in just a moment.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are here with Chuck Coughlin running down the cast of thousands of Democratic candidates. We left it at, I'd like to make a point about Elizabeth Warren and get you to react to it. The downside, I mean, has Trump tagged her with this Pocahontas thing in a way that's irretrievable? The other point, however, I would make is her weakness, that I think, is that she's tagged with a one-liner.
Mm-hmm.
If you listen to her talk and answer questions mm-hmm. for a half hour, she is very, very impressive. But the one
to people
liner,
like you and me, maybe yeah. she's impressive. The challenge is that she sort of got that Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, problem. She's a nerd.
Yeah,
I mean, she's a policy nerd,
mm-hmm.
Which is great.
We just elected one mayor of Phoenix.
Yeah, exactly. But you know, how do you translate that into enthusiasm on the trail? I mean, I could clearly see her being part of a cabinet and being part of a resurgence of the regulatory state, particularly on Wall Street and on some of these, on some of our banking institutions and that. I just don't see her capturing the imagination of the progressive part of the Democratic Party, that enthusiasm that we spoke about earlier with the rise in Democratic vote and the younger part of the Democratic Party. I don't see her grabbing a hold of that. And that's where I look at Kamala Harris as the opportunity to narrate to that part of the base.
Well, I had Harris in my second tier, and then I thought about it and moved her to the third to make room for Beto O'Rourke, who I think is Mr. Enthusiasm.
He is Mr. Enthusiasm, but he's the white guy. He's the white guy problem, too, again, that we talked about earlier.
Doesn't he remind you of Robert Kennedy?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, he's got the white sleeve, the white shirt, and the sleeves rolled up, and you know, handsome guy, and has
energy,
a great deal of enthusiasm.
Physical energy,
yeah. But where does he have the experience that a Harris has? I don't think so. I don't think that he does. I'm not as familiar with his background, but
if we want experience, we're voting for Sanders or Biden.
Well, but you could argue, being the Attorney General of California is a hell of a big job. And it is a big job.
It is inarguably a big job.
It's a much bigger job than the U.S. Senate candidate from California, you know, being a senator from California, because you have so many issues that you have to engage on. And so I would argue that having a statewide elected underneath her belt is a big positive. Then you get to the tactical level of the conversation, the tactical level meaning that you got two states early that are predominantly like 98% white, right? Iowa and New Hampshire. And then it explodes. I mean, the way they've now front-loaded Super Tuesday.
California's way.
California's in it. And then you're going to have early voting in some of those states before Super Tuesday. I think Nevada, Ohio, you'll get early voting.
Hey, folks,
starting.
If you're in one of those states, don't vote early. That landscape is going to change.
But you know the activist base is going to be out there moving that. Those campaigns that are engaged and have funding and have momentum will be doing that. And so you have this explosion, and you got South Carolina up front there, and those Super Tuesday states. You have it's a very much more diverse population that's going to be voting early in those populations. That's where I look at Harris. You would say O'Rourke as one of those candidates that's going to emerge if they can narrate a successful path via Bernie and Joe.
I think you've a key there. Going to emerge. My third group is the group who is in the could emerge category. And you'll notice I've omitted a whole lot of names. I think they're the ones that aren't going anywhere. But my third group is Booker, Klobuchar. I said Harris. So Harris, either two or three. But
yeah.
Booker and Klobuchar.
I'll give you Booker and Klobuchar in that line. But Klobuchar's had some staff problem, a little bit of a narrative problem.
When the first
thing
that comes out about you is negative, it's a problem.
Yeah, that's a problem. That's when most people get to know you. And so that's hard. It's that old head and shoulders thing. It's never a second time to make a first impression.
Honorable mentions to two people, neither of whom I think has a chance, but both of whom impressed me when I watched them in one-on-one interviews. Governor Jay Inslee of Washington, and Pete, I'm going to butcher his name, Buttigieg, South Bend Mayor. Both very impressive. Neither going to win, but very, very impressive.
Can add to the discussion.
Yep.
But again, it's going to be this contest, I think, when it runs down into that Super Tuesday. Who's narrating a populist economic narrative that's not Bernie, that's not socialism, that doesn't scare the hell out of the rest of the country, but can still maintain support amongst that progressive base of Democrats.
If Elizabeth Warren could get a long enough forum, you know, I think she may be killed by the one word epithet. Right.
It doesn't have the elevator speech going on. Whereas Harris, as a prosecutor, is used to closing arguments, and
Biden was a world class debater.
Yes, you know, and Biden's going to be, you know, it'll be in the wake of Biden because everybody, all the gravity be around what Biden is doing.
The argument for Biden would be, we want the opposite of what we just had. What have we had? We're all at one another's throats. The temperature is high. Biden is the lower the temperature kind of.
You and I get that, but I can, you know, the tenor of the left is, you know, they've got their own Tea Party problem now.
Yeah.
They got the Tea Party problem on the left.
The appeal of Biden would be, let's stop fighting one another. Let's get somebody that we can all live with who's not going to, reignite the third serve war.
But that is, I'm reminded by the younger people, Paul Bentz in my office, we get into this great discussion all the time about, you know, the hard left is similar to the hard right in that, you know, they're not listening. They want blood.
Yep.
You know, they want blood in the morning. So.
Okay, one last. First to drop out, my candidates, Gillibrand, Castro, Gabbard. Did I miss anybody else in terms of anybody out of the other crowd you want to nominate as viable?
No, I think we've talked about them all. And I think
are they going to get Howard Schultz out?
No, I think Howard can go in really late. I think he can go in late as an independent. He's the big counterweight to this whole thing to say, if you nominate a true progressive that is unelectable, I think he runs.
And that's the kiss of death to the Democrats.
Yep.
Exactly.
Because they leave the middle of the field wide open.
Absolutely. And he will steal votes from Democrats, not from Trump.
Yep.
Okay, we will be back. We will talk about the Republican side of all this.
Just when you think she's at one in the world, your heart gets stolen by some massive little girl, and then you know you better make up your mind and pick up on one and leave the other behind.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are talking first run at presidential politics with Chuck Coughlin. We played the Democratic field in the last half hour. Republicans, is there anybody that is a viable primary challenger to Donald Trump? Governor Weld of Massachusetts is in. Kasich?
Probably Kasich. But you
Does either of them have a chance?
You use the word viable. No.
No.
You know, running in against an incumbent president with Trump's base of populism amongst the hardcore part of the Republican Party, the loyalty oath that's been applied to everybody in the party, you know, there's very little room between Trump and anybody else in the Republican Party.
Okay, let's assume for purposes of analysis that for whatever reason Donald Trump is out.
Well, I don't think we're going to go there.
Okay. But I'm just for now. I just want to clean if he's out
if
without
he's
getting
out.
Why.
Right.
Who's in?
Well, I would think it'd be Pence. I would think
he obviously would he'd be a president at that time.
Yes, and it would have to be an orchestrated move, and you know it might be Pence and like somebody like Nikki Haley.
Terms of renomination, you think Pence would be a lock? You couldn't see a Romney or anybody?
No. It's got to be somebody that's very, 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 very close to Trump, but not Trump.
And that is the
role that's not a family member of Trump's.
And that is the role that Pence would play.
Right.
Has played.
Yeah. I mean, we saw this similar, you know, 1972. We saw that. It was the Nixon to Ford move at the end there. And, you know, you've seen Pence now do quite a bit more. He was out here doing a manufacturers conference last week. He was down in South America, in Colombia recently, orchestrating some of the.
How strong a candidate would he be?
Oh, I think he'd be much stronger than people think. I don't think Democrats want to see that. I don't think they want to see it because, you know, he is very conservative.
I don't see him commanding the emotional affect that Trump does.
Well, you don't. But that's going to be if Trump's not there, he inherits that though. Mm-hmm. He inherits the that mantle of those folks with – it's got to be with Donald's blessing. That's
okay,
the only
let's
way
return
that
to the juicier question. As you alluded to at the end of last year, you said I 0% estimate that Donald Trump is – I forget whether you said at the end of this year or
on
the
ticket.
By the spring. Spring of 2020.
2020.
A year from in the next year.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the next year, you think he is out.
I do. I don't know why Mueller and his team have taken an exhaustive time with this. My own experience with this with federal investigators is mature. I experienced that with our former governor, Symington.
No, they are thorough.
When they investigated him for 7 years. And so when you give smart people that much time that have a badge and a subpoena power and a grand jury, you're going to get stuff.
They can get through when people put up a wall of obfuscation or what. They can break
through.
And then they'll get you on that. Well, and they'll get somebody to break because they'll threaten somebody with prosecution. Cohen, for example, who was Trump's closest guy, flipped because he said, I'm not going down for the rest of my life.
So he's saying, no collusion. Okay, maybe they don't get collusion. Maybe they get tax fraud. Maybe they get obstruction of justice. Maybe they get out and out fraud on business dealings.
They already have two of his closest people going to prison already.
Maybe they get some level of cooperation with some of this Russian stuff that went on. I mean, I've told people this when we worked for the Trump organization, we being High Ground worked when we did their zoning case at 26th Street and Camelback, and I was aware that Bayrock, the company that was doing that, was Russian money. That was back then, and so when the wall fell and when the Putin began to take over. Even before that, there was a lot of Russian money trying to get out of the country and get into other investment opportunities. They saw Donald Trump, those oligarks, so many of them
the
saw
Russians
Donald Trump.
Like the Chinese to get money.
Absolutely.
They want to get that money out of the country.
Out of the country and into American markets and into greenbacks. Mm-hmm. And so, that was something they were very – and he was very welcoming of that opportunity, obviously. That was right after the bankruptcy with the New Jersey casino. And so he was looking at that. And so
I hope you got your fee up front.
I got paid. We didn't accomplish what we needed to do. Greg Stanton wouldn't give us the height that we wanted on that corner. And now they have a building there that's going to probably be torn down in 30 years because it's just I think it's 4 or 5 stories and it's wood construction. So that's not going to last very long. But, it didn't go. And so, that was my impression back then that Felix Sater, one of the guys that was involved in that, is just going to get called in front of Congress here very shortly. He was up to get called last week. I think they delayed that. So, I got a little with my Fife experience, with that experience, I have a little bit of insight into the thoroughness of what's going to be happening here and some of the background there in the Trump world.
Well, he's clearly got Russian connections. That is not a crime.
No.
Then you follow the money.
As Mr. Manafort failed to disclose those investments.
That is a crime.
And those pays, that becomes a crime when you're involved in taking money from foreign governments. And so, we're going to find out. And that's going to make this last part, this spring, very, very interesting to see how this all evolves. The report will go to the Justice Department. The Attorney General will redact it substantially on whatever grounds he feels is necessary for redaction, gets handed over to the Congress, and then the circus begins.
I find it hard to believe that they could redact the essence of it. They can take out some names if there's some security or whatever, but what's in there,
that's going to be a big discussion, is what's the Attorney General allowed to redact? Why did you redact this? That's going to become part of the discussion here, too, as to why that happened and what legal standard you're using to do that. And that's going to become – that's the rabbit trail they're going to start going down. So this is going to be a you know, and that's why I think Biden's announcement is probably going to be delayed sometime. If I'm them, I wait for this, like I said, the snow globe to settle down.
Yeah,
it's going to get shaken up.
I hadn't thought of that, but that's brilliant. You don't want to announce and then 12 hours later
you're irrelevant. Right.
Well, not irrelevant, but you're superseded. You don't get the bump because you're talking, once the Mueller report is out, we're going to talk about nothing else for weeks.
For weeks. And then what Biden would have an opportunity to do once that begins to settle out is contrast with this presidency and the Obama presidency and his role in that and his role in being, you know, an upstanding, decent American, you know, his roots, his story, his background versus the trouble that we have now.
Okay. The Mueller report comes out. It's got a lot of bad stuff in it. But ultimately, you could get the votes in the House, but the House probably shouldn't touch it unless there's a reasonable prospect of a conviction in the Senate. That's 2/3. That would require a whole bunch of Republicans to break.
Right.
When does the dam break on that or start to crumble?
Well, we're seeing that a little bit. We saw that a little bit this week with the Senate failing to sustain his vote on the emergency on the Mexican border. So there has been a break. I mean, there's beginning to be a break here with some of that. We wouldn't have imagined that 2 years ago. I mean, you remember the intense pressure McCain was under the Affordable Health Care Act vote and Flake. We're not hearing that kind of narrative out of the White House anymore, eviscerating Republicans on the Senate. He's being very careful about doing that now. And so that's changed. And so what we'll end up with is next spring.
That Trump hasn't gone after individual senators.
Correct. Mm-hmm. He's not not as badly as he was. I mean, you know, no,
let's
there's no
it,
Jeff Flakes.
He can't completely help himself there.
Yeah, he can't. But then you'll have the you know, the spring's going to roll around and the map this time, Mitch McConnell has 22 Republican seats that he has to defend. There's only, I think, a dozen Democrats. The shoe's on the other foot in this cycle.
It is the map this coming time is exactly the opposite. Democrats lost, I think, 2 seats last time. If you looked at the map they had to defend, they were already at the upper limit of what you could get.
Yes.
The exact opposite is true in the next time.
The exact opposite is true. The balance of the Senate is in question. Mitch McConnell's authority as
Republicans have to defend a lot of seats that are vulnerable. Democrats minimally.
Yeah. Listeners should go look at the map.
Yep.
Go look at the map.
Look at the map.
The 2020 Senate races. How many of those races are in states where Clinton won last time and with Republican senators that are up? It's going to be, you know, there's nothing like self-interest in Washington, D.C. It is the currency of Washington, D.C. And Mitch McConnell is going to be looking at his bank account of self-interest is going to be rising steadily over
the first thing
spring.
Every elected says is, well, unless I survive, I can't do anything.
I can't do anything.
And so that becomes predominant. We will be back to wrap this with Chuck Coughlin talking all things politics, particularly at the presidential level in the think tank on KTAR.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're here with Chuck Coughlin wrapping up our discussion of 2020 presidential politics. You think Donald Trump is not going to be around in the 2020 election. I'm having difficulty seeing how we get from here to there. I'm seeing really minimal cracks in the Trump base.
I agree. It's a hard thing to imagine. It's a very hard thing to figure out given the timelines that we have in front of us, the primaries. And so what?
Well, it's Mueller report, right? That's the big thing.
Right,
that comes out. And how bad is that?
But I'm talking about next spring when we're looking at that map that McConnell has to defend,
which is tough. Yes.
And you got a Republican convention in South Carolina. And Trump will have been on the ballot in most of all those places and will have won. He'll have secured the nomination. And every poll, unless the Democrats implode, which is not beyond the realm of possibility. I'm going to presume they don't implode. That it's a Biden, Harris, maybe Beto, maybe.
I think we got to see how these folks right. perform. We don't know that. They're
not
be
Bernie.
On the
yeah. If it's Bernie, that's I think it's an implosion if it's Bernie.
Well, it could be. I think he's in tier one.
Right. You know? And he's in tier one right now.
And remember what we said about, you know, so-and-so has a cap, right? Yeah. We said that all last yeah. time.
Well, there was an interesting article in one of those articles I was reading about how he's in first or second place in the – but he's also – When you ask people name identification and then first choice, he gets a good number. He's up there for that reason. But other people's name ID where he loses out is he's not anybody's second choice.
Yeah,
he's there.
You like him or you don't like
right.
him.
Right, yeah. And it's about 25% of the Democratic Party that's there right now. And so, you know, it's the erosion. I would argue he's sort of hitting a ceiling right now. And so. So they do what they do.
We said that about
they
Trump.
Do what they do. Right. They're doing their own moment here, and if they don't, if they actually nominate somebody that's competitive, all those national polls are going to. A Trump presidency, in my view, is incapable of articulating on its own a majority coalition. I said this a year ago that they're not talking to a majority of the electorate. They're talking to a bare majority of the Republican Party.
And whenever he has had an opportunity to expand that, he's declined.
No,
and he's doubled down on the base with greater and greater, more committed. I mean, I really think with that group, he was absolutely right. He could go out on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody. They're still with him.
Right. I mean, how do you narrate to – you got to keep Republican women at home. That base has been eroding from him. We saw that a little bit in Arizona in this last cycle in terms of defections onto the Democratic side. And then PN party not disclosed in independents, 28% of the electorate or so, they're not getting them. I mean, so they're not getting them. And so how do you create a majority electoral coalition going into the general election? My argument is if all those things happen, that the Democrats have a viable national candidate going, I think the convention will recognize that. Trump may recognize that, and I think that's where you get a switch at the convention in Carolina.
He takes a pass on a nomination that's already in hand.
Reanimates the entire thing, throws a giant monkey wrench into the whole plan.
That is a totally different.
He goes and leads the resistance movement outside.
And he gets indicted. Well, I don't know.
I don't know if he's getting indicted. You know, I don't know.
You're giving us two scenarios here.
Yeah.
You have the legal one.
Yes.
Which involves losing support in the Senate among Republicans.
Yes.
Those folks have been pretty loyal to. They're afraid of him.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
They're afraid of him in terms of being primary. Now, maybe if you did this after.
Yeah.
But anything on Manafort or whatever, that impeachment, that is going to be – if that doesn't happen well before the primary, it's not going to happen.
Is there a walk down – is there a 1972-esque walk with McConnell down to the White House this spring when all of this stuff is going to be – in you know, next spring when all this stuff is going to be happening?
McConnell says you've got no support.
Well, the first conversation is going to be with the vice president going, how do we win?
Yeah.
How do we win? There's no scenario in which we are seeing electorally how we win with the Democrats positioned where they are.
And clearly that's what McConnell wants.
I mean, Pelosi knows that.
That's
what Pelosi's managing this discussion right now. And so he forces it into an elective atmosphere where Trump is wounded. Inability to talk to a majority of the electorate, and then do you get a Pence and Haley Barbour ticket? Or not Haley, but Nikki Haley.
Nikki Haley with either of them. But
yeah. And so does that end up transpiring at the convention?
And McConnell would love that. But Donald Trump's problem was if he doesn't run for re-election on January 20th of 2021, he's subject to indictment.
No, he's not. You know that, and I know that, because before he leaves the White House, before Pence leaves the, you know,
that's the deal. Pence pardons him.
Pence pardons him. Absolutely.
Pence pardons him on the morning of
last day in office. Remember, Bill Clinton's pardons. Bill issued.
You have Trump leaving the office, allowing Pence to run as an incumbent.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
But so that pardon would come after the election, before inauguration.
Yeah. A lot of moving pieces.
Well, if
here.
They'd have to do this late, because otherwise he resigns, Pence takes over, he's subject to indictment immediately, maybe in New York State.
Well, and then that's only going to fuel the base. I mean, that would fuel the base.
Yeah.
And you'll have a chorus of people going, let's not go
back.
But
then Pence is a one-term president.
If he gets elected, he pardons
after election.
Yeah.
He pardons after election. He does a complete pardon of everybody.
If he wins.
Yeah. He's totally unpopular. It's the Gerald Ford situation, who was sky high in popularity until he pardon Nixon. That seemed like a dirty deal.
Yeah.
He would have been elected president.
Yeah. So, this is what they write novels about. You would not believe this as a novel. Yeah, you couldn't even believe it as a novel. But, that's the kind of plays that everybody should be paying attention to and watching as this all things unfold. Unfortunately, we all get stuck in the daily internet rut of whatever the daily news story is, which helps this kind of narrative develop. It's like you can do this over on the side over here while all the other chaos is running around.
How you could play out. And do not forget the role of accident in all this. Jeff Greenfield wrote a wonderful little short novel called 43 Asterisk, and it was based on the following premise. Julio Gonzalez, the kid, his mother, they're both in this boat from Cuba, and the kid lives, the mother dies, okay? This is the change in scenario. I wrote the book based on that. What if his mother lived?
Mm.
If his mother lived, there's no raid on the house because he's with his mother. That's the end of it.
They live in
Florida. It flips 50,000 Cuban votes in Florida, and Al Gore is president.
Yeah.
And then he takes steps from there and presents a very plausible scenario about what happened with 9/11 and a whole lot of other stuff, all of which was very plausible based on,
as we all know,
one silly little
the threads thing, of history that things tip one way or the other on are fascinating to go back and look at.
There's a lot of big forces.
You don't see it in the cacophony and noise that's happening right now, but those are the things that will tip one way or the other.
Well, Chuck, we'll have you back. We want to have a discussion like this.
Maybe.
About Arizona politics.
You could have me back a year from now, and I'll look like a total crazy man, too.
We do have this on tape. And if you turn out to be flat wrong, right or wrong, we're gonna replay. The killer suggestion was Donald Trump is going to be out. You said it a year ago, and nobody else was saying it. We'll see.
By the convention.
Yep. Okay, we're in the think tank at KTAR. You may catch a podcast at ktar.com and older ones at mikeoneal.org.